Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Well, California primary, their so-called jungle primary yesterday, right? It's all candidates on the ballot. The party affiliation is irrelevant. The top two finishers go on, because so you could have two Republicans, you could have two Democrats. And you would think in a state where Dem registration outpaces Republican registration by like 4-1, you would have perhaps two Democrat candidates for governor. But not so fast. The former mayor of Los Angeles, Antonio Villagrosa, never took off. And so what you have is the former Mr. Kimberly Guilfoyle, Gavin Newsom.
Oh, that's right.
Moonbeam's lieutenant governor, former mayor of San Francisco, against a former perennial candidate from Illinois, just 10 years removed, John Cox.
Yeah, he now lives with his beautiful wife, Sarah, in San Diego, and he decided to run. He's always been, I met him, when he was running for U.S. Senate. Remember that one?
In 2002, he ran for U.S. Senate in the primary here. Lost that in that primary. I think it was a three-way primary to Jim Durkin, who then, of course, summarily went on and got crushed by Dick Durbin.
Exactly.
Before that, he ran for Congress in the 10th District when John Porter retired, another crowded primary to replace John Porter that Mark Kirk won.
And then he ran for county assessor against
Recorder of Deeds.
Oh, Recorder of Deeds.
Against Gene Moore.
And then he promised that if he won that race, he would shut down that department.
Right.
That was his sole mission.
So that was running for Cook County wide. There hasn't been a Republican elected Cook County wide in Illinois since Jack O'Malley 25 years ago.
You're digging deep there.
Well, so John Cox, he knows what it's like to run in the landscape like California because he's running Cook County. And then in 2008, he ran sort of a bizarre bizarre race for president of the United States in the Republican primary.
Mm-hmm. I didn't even hear about that.
Nobody did. Because it was just very, very strange.
Was he trying to get his name out there on a national level so people in California might know who he is?
I don't know. I don't know exactly what the thinking behind it was. But I mentioned this yesterday. There was a great Weekly Standard piece by Matt Labash, who actually went to talk to John Cox when he was running for president, and he was trying to get into the GOP
debate.
And he did not get into the GOP debate. And so they went to Cox's hotel room, wait for it, and they watched the debate on television, and then John Cox just answered for Matt Labash in the hotel room the questions that were being asked of the candidates on TV, and that was his way
That's
of participating
cool.
in the debate.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So should I disclose what I know now about John Cox?
Please.
No, I dated John Cox's brother-in-law
of course.
For three
Was he a competitive eater?
No, he was not the competitive eater.
Was he the guy on that played the lieutenant on Miami Vice?
No.
I can't keep track of
these. So Sarah Hall's little brother is Jamie Hall, and I dated him.
Oh, Jamie Hall.
You know Jamie Hall.
No, I don't. Yeah. No, it's Jamie. The way you say these, like, oh, of course, Hall.
Well, I thought we all went out one time.
No.
No? But John used to live on, he had a beautiful penthouse.
Oh.
On Michigan Avenue.
Well, sure, of course. High society.
Yes, we're high society. It was nice.
How'd
a little girl.
What happened to you guys?
How
did you guys, how'd you grow apart?
Maybe it was just not meant to be.
Was the family too political for you?
No.
Is that it?
No.
Did he want you to move to California
and
to be part of the first family?
Absolutely
oh,
not.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. But it is correct. I mean, good for him. I mean, that just shows that persistence through the decades sometimes might pay off.
It's a wild story to think
it's
about
so
that.
Wild.
And it says something about California. It also says something about Illinois and where Illinois is going, what's happening in California. Because you have 10 years removed from running for all these offices here. He goes out to California.
Another corrupt state.
Well, yeah, but I mean, it tells you there's no Republican Party in California.
Right, but we should stand behind him because he is a conservative Republican and he's trying to change the way things are done in California.
There's no question about it.
We put a businessman in the White House. Let's put a businessman in the governor's mansion, huh? Yes.
Maybe you could work with him.
Well, there's so many people to thank. And, of course, this is only the first step to turning around this state and taking back California for all Californians.
Woohoo!
I heard Sarah. With, wooing.
I think that was Jamie. I'm not sure.
Sarah has a twin sister, too. What was her name? Susan. Anywho.
Oh, right. Sure. Susan. Yeah. Of course. The Halls.
You met her, too,
no,
right? At that
I didn't.
Party that
her.
I hypothetically put you in.
Cox did say something, though, that is relevant to Illinois, in addition to California, obviously.
One party rule in Sacramento is bad enough. But one-party elections is just plain un-American.
And I'll tell you what, what's happened in California is you had one-party elections, so you have a one-party state, and, again, functionally no Republican Party. And what's happening in Illinois is because, in part, we've conceded Chicago for so many years to be one-party elections. We're having a one-party state. We're getting a one-party state, and the Republican Party, of course, complicit and corrupt, at least, compromised. At least in California, even though the distribution of congressmen is 39-14, Democrats, wow, Republican, but a lot of those 14 are actual conservatives. So they do have some standard bearers there. I mean, think Devin Nunes, think Daryl Issa, Dana Rohrabacher. So there's some, but it's just instructive when you cede elections, when you don't build infrastructure, when you don't recruit talent, you can have, I don't mean to denigrate John Cox, but it's remarkable. The biggest state in the nation, and you have just a kind of a perennial candidate also ran from Illinois, can just go out there and 10 years later, he can be the Republican nominee for governor.
Hey, it's all about who's number two in California. I mean, I was surprised. He was up in the polls when I checked in yesterday, and he had the backing of President Trump. President Trump even tweeted yesterday, go out and vote for John Cox.
And you appreciate it. You know, maybe Cox can put a marker down for Republicans there. He's certainly not trying to two-step being a conservative or being a Trump defender.
First message, and that is it wasn't Donald Trump who made California the highest tax state in the country. It was Gavin Newsom and the Democrats. It wasn't President Trump who gave us a $52 billion gas tax increase without any reform of Caltrans, one of the most wasteful and inefficient agencies in the country. It wasn't Donald Trump who gave us that gas tax. It was Gavin Newsom, and we're going to repeal that tax in November.
And his first act, were he to be elected governor, shock the Western Hemisphere and be elected?
And it wasn't Donald Trump that passed the sanctuary state. Gavin, you did that. You're the one that's protecting MS-13. You're the one that's making our communities less safe. The first role of government is to protect the people. And the first act I make is to get rid of this sanctuary state law.
I have to check in with all my relatives in California and my friends to make sure that they're going to be supporting him.
Well, I'll tell you what. He's bringing it. He's bringing the fight. So you got to respect that. And you appreciate it, given how steep the incline is that he's trying to climb. But I tell you, it's so instructive for Illinois, especially because of John Cox's history here. When you fail to hold politicians accountable, and that's what both parties in the state have done. Nobody in my lifetime has held politicians in their party accountable. And what happens is one of the parties can disappear. as the culture shifts, as the demographic shift. And that's what happened in California, and that's what's happening in Illinois.
It's like a hot, steaming cup of information to start your day. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
You know, processing loss is hard for me because we don't take L's at Blaine. That was our joke all year. And our 7th and 8th grade team, which had Peyton and Eli on, we won the first game, lost the second game 25-23, and then in the third game we just shat ourselves and lost 15-10.
You soiled yourselves.
That's what I meant to say. Soiled. It was awful. But here's the...
This program is on the air. I wanted you to know.
Oh, we're on?
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. So here you go. Since you're the franchise owner. It's,
you think I accept a second place trophy?
But wait. There's more. Hold on.
Get that junk out of here.
Hold on. Big news. Big exciting news.
All right. She's left the studio. She's coming back into the studio. Oh, that's...
My fifth
that looks
and sixth
like
grade boys team won. We beat Disney in two games. And look at that. Franchise owner.
Is this a taxpayer? These trophies taxpayer funded?
Isn't that nice?
They're very nice. That's why I'm thinking.
I was so proud of our boys, but it was just hard because then after the fifth and sixth grade game, then Peyton and Eli, their team lost, and we were undefeated. Both teams were undefeated during the regular season, and then that happened. But you know what it's all about? Serves. We missed 21 serves at the 7th and 8th grade team.
Sounds like a failure to coaching.
Oh, because it is always all about the coaching.
So are you? Did you do like a little tour of this to the Lakeview Gin Mills?
Like it is, it is going to the Cubs game tomorrow.
Uh huh.
And then on Friday it's going to Wicker Park, and then on Saturday it's going to the pitch. Yeah, we're gonna, you know.
But then there's some kind of trophy, taxpayer funded trophy case for the taxpayer funded trophies at Blaine. They don't keep trophies at the school.
No. Well, we keep them at the school, but we keep them on top of a bookcase.
Oh.
We don't have a.
You don't have, you don't,
special trophy
you can't profile
case.
Trophies anymore because that could make some people feel bad
no.
who aren't on the team, who didn't participate in the victory.
Who didn't make the team. But yeah, not everybody played, but you know what I said? You all did something throughout the season to get us to the championship game, which is true.
Well, convey to the 7th and 8th grade team that they're a big disappointment to
me. Stop it. But for me personally, because I did something that men have been doing since the beginning of sports. And that's being able to coach your sons. Women don't coach their sons in anything, really. So this is the first time that I was able to do something that a man could do.
And it was a disaster.
Shut up. Don't make me feel bad. We had an undefeated season, and now they're all going to go on and play in high school. And Eli has next year. So next year, mark my words, we are winning this at the 7th and 8th grade level. All right.
All right. Very good.
I've already got plans.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy continues right now. And make sure to join me, Sean Hannity, this afternoon starting at 2 right here on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. So, no Eagles at the White House yesterday. Philadelphia variety, of course. The mayor, Jim Kenney, Philadelphia mayor, he said something rather interesting in an interview with your girlfriend there, Don Lemon, on CNN about Trump. He was very critical of Trump. He's, you know, disgrace to the country and all that. Then he said about just standing for the anthem, hand over heart generally, why he does it, but others don't need to necessarily.
There, I stand for the national anthem and cover my heart because I am a privileged white male, and I have a reason to stand. There are other people in this country who have not experienced the same level of fairness and same level of issues that I have, and they have a right to show their displeasure. And that's what the First Amendment's all about. And if he doesn't want to accept the First Amendment or other amendments, that's on him.
Yeah, I mean, it's the sophistry of making this a First Amendment issue. It's not. Of course, people have the right to not stand for the anthem or to protest the flag or the country or speak their piece, as long as they do so peaceably.
But if your boss and the league is saying we have new rules, without rules, there's chaos, and you have to follow the rules.
Or it's a First Amendment violation to not invite a team that wins a championship to the White House. I mean, this is the sophistry of the left, and the whole I'm a white privileged male. I mean, it's the poison of identity politics on full display there. And I'll tell you what, they think, the likes of Jim Kenney think, I'm standing with the masses. I'm standing with the people, right? I'm down with the
struggle.
Downtrodden,
the people who are wrongly accused, you know, that are the victims of police brutality. And that's what April Ryan, she said, the whole taking a knee is about stopping police brutality. And she interrupted the press conference yesterday and listened to Sarah Sanders put her in her place.
One last question, Stephen.
About police-involved shootings. Is the president aware that this is police-involved shootings and not about disrespecting the flag? Is the president aware
that,
Sarah,
please?
I understand you're going to Stephen, but I'm asking. There's an underlying issue, and it just keeps going about disrespect of the flag and soldiers. There are black and brown soldiers that fight in the military as well who feel that taking a knee, bringing attention to police-involved shootings is something that this White House should deal with. Is the president aware that taking the knee is about police-involved shootings?
The president has made his position crystal clear, and that it's about... I let you rudely interrupt me and your colleague. I'm going to ask that you allow me to finish my answer. I would be happy to answer it if you would stop talking long enough to let me do that.
Yeah, I mean, they think they're down with the struggle. Wow. And by the way, this is not just the province of the left, but it bleeds over to some sort of never-Trumpers or inclined to be never-Trumpers on the right, like Jonah Goldberg. He tweeted yesterday, "The attempt to make the Eagles' event cancellation about the national anthem is just a complete act of deceitful propaganda, and conservatives should have zero to do with it. If that was the issue, why schedule the event in the first place? Also, none of them kneeled. Shameful." It's almost a Trumpian-like tweet directed at Trump. He has a point. Why invite him in the first place? I mean, maybe it's just the inertia of doing these things that presidents do for championship teams for many generations now. But the decision to cancel it, let's say it's not about the anthem. Let's say it's about... only a handful of players wanted to come, and many did not. And they were going to make a political statement and make a spectacle in that way by only having a fraction of the team show up. And so Trump said, "The hell with it." Well, what's wrong with that?
No. 312-642-5600 is our turnkey.pro answer line. 64636. Type in DA, then a quick comment. Well, 10 to 15 players were going to show up, and they wanted to show up. But President Trump had said there's fans out here waiting and to have them sit out there and wait for their favorite players, and not a lot of their favorite players are showing up. It's not worth it. So instead, he did something I thought that was brilliant. He honored veterans yesterday instead of honoring the Philadelphia Eagles. And they sang the national anthem. One agitator in the crowd took a knee. Did you see that?
No.
Oh, I was just goofy. But, that was good. People who fought for this country were honored instead of, overpaid professional athletes who are snobs.
Well, I don't like jingoism and, politicians that go over the top with respect to wrapping themselves in the flag. Okay. And as I said, Goldberg's criticism of Trump, there's a point there because there was this planned and then it was canceled last minute. And I think, again, it was heading off a political spectacle, and maybe Trump spun it a bit to say this was about the anthem rather than the Eagles making a political spectacle of themselves for the purpose of embarrassing the president and giving the D.C. press corps something to write about and opine about, which, of course, they are doing anyway in the light of the cancellation. And also, it's a way for Trump to present a choice to the American people. You may have some qualms with me, but which side of the skirmish line are you on with people who don't want to respect our country or think the way they respect the country is by demagoguing police officers? Because that's really, the whole kind of, this is about police brutality. It kind of sort of is for some of them.
It started that way.
It started that way for some of the individuals,
right? And then it just varied off into obscurism.
Well,
what are we protesting now?
It just became all courant. I mean, it's like Black Lives Matter. It started as police brutality, and then they're you know, of talking about climate change and everything else. It's just a manifestation of the left. But here's the point I want to get back to, too, because April Ryan did it and the mayor, Kinney of Philadelphia, did it, too. We're down with the struggle. And the way we're down with the struggle is by attacking Trump and providing political cover to people who demagogue the country, who inflame tensions along identity lines. That's how we show we're down with the struggle. And you know what? That's exactly how tone deaf the Democrats are. And some other Democrats are picking up on this. It's very interesting over the last couple of days with Howard Schultz stepping down as chairman of Starbucks right. and all the speculation that he may run for president. And then Chris Matthews on Morning Joe yesterday. Listen to Howard Schultz on CNBC talking about his concerns about his party, Democrats.
I will say that it concerns me that so many voices within the Democratic Party are going so far to the left. And I ask myself, how are we going to pay for all these things in terms of things like single payer or people espousing the fact that the government is going to give everyone a job? I don't think that's realistic. And I think we've got to get away from all of these falsehoods and start talking about the truth and not false promises.
Boy, he's going to have a tough road in the primary with that kind of talk, isn't he?
Oh, my gosh. Bernie Sanders is going to bury him.
Well, not
because all the kiddies want free college, and that's why they're all supporter fans or fans of Bernie Sanders.
Well, right. And
sounds great. But, yeah, I'd like free college, too, or free education.
Well, the issue is the country ready to, you know, make difficult adult decisions about what we want at somebody else's forced expense?
I want to hear what Chris Matthews had to say.
So Matthews talked about, you know, he's always hearkening back to the Kennedy era. He still has the kind of Camelot visage in his head. But there is a point that he makes about where the Democrats have gone and where they're going to continue to stay if they don't change their way.
A true Democrat, lowercase d, thinks they're no better than anybody else. That's what a Democrat is. And when the party regains that with white, black, Hispanic people, everybody starts to think of themselves as one of them instead of being better than them, they'll get back to the party of the people. And they're not there yet. There's too many elitism. There's so much elitism in the Democratic Party. It's so outrageous. And it all comes to the notion of the meritocracy being entirely academic based. You don't want to hear about a master plumber being an elite. He is, or she is. But it's all academic, and it's a game they've been playing with themselves, and it's self-saluting. And I'm telling you, the people feel it. There's a party going on, and they ain't invited to it. And that's a big part of this. It's not just economics. I don't buy the whole Marxist argument. It's all about economics. It's not all about economics. It's about sensing that your leaders give a damn about you personally.
Wow. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 646-36-DA, turnkey.pro, text line. Is Chris Matthews had an epiphany?
Howard Schultz had.
Well, Howard Schultz, that's not an epiphany for Schultz, but Matthews about the self-saluting. That's what the Philly mayor is doing. Does Trump do that too? Sure he does. But I mean, but you're talking about the philosophy of the party is all self-reverential, self-saluting, with deference to elites that have academic credentials and profile in our society to the expense of those who do not. And in 2016, those who do not said, go pound sand, right? I said this before. I'll say it again. Punished economically, ridiculed culturally, and people are sick of it. I know I am. Tim in Woodstock, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hi, good morning, Dan and Amy. You know, the idea that the national anthem serves as some kind of a theme song for people who feel privileged in this country is really a sickening thought. There's plenty of white people who are down on their luck, who struggle, who are poor. And, you know, and the idea that we should only sing if we feel privileged is just, it just, I don't know, it just turns my stomach. And I just want to say that I love the president. I love so many of the things he's doing. But I thought it would have been better to just, if there were just one guy who wanted to come to the White House, I would have let him come. I would have given him a great day, maybe go play golf together. I think it would have served as an example to the others.
Yeah, that's actually a fair point. Thanks for the call, Tim. I like that. I like that idea. hey, if only 5 or 10 or 1 is going to come, fine. I'll entertain right. the 5 or the 10 or the 1. We'll have a good old time.
Yeah.
It's not a bad idea. Yeah, okay. And by the way, the Michelle Obama moment with Kenny, you know, first time I'm proud of my country, I agree with Tim. The idea that because some people have been wronged in this country, and oh, by the way, at the hands of the government, right? The anthem is about we the people. The anthem isn't about the federal government. Because some people have been wronged, you have nothing to be proud of in this country because there's been unfairness, because there's been, you know, atrocities committed by some Americans at the expense of others. All that's true.
Mm-hmm.
And yet it's still the greatest country in the history of the world. And a man has fallen. So you're going to have man's, you know, barbaric acts against man.
And the mayor of Philadelphia, he's just trying to make a national name for himself.
The identity politics is so anti-intellectual. They should be embarrassed. All these elites with these wonderful academic credentials, they're frauds. Mike in Bowling Brook.
Yeah, this puke in Philadelphia, the mayor of Philadelphia. Self-privileged? How does he describe himself as self-privileged? He probably had a silver spoon in his mouth his whole life. He's ridiculous.
Thanks, Mike. Dan in Libertyville.
Two things. One, Chris Matthews said master plumbers are an elite. I'm a master plumber. We're going to have a good laugh at the supply house, slapping each other on the back, telling each other we're elite.
Go through a high-five tunnel on the way to work today. Like, hey,
I'm
everybody.
I'm telling you, we're going to be loving that.
Yeah, well, at least got a hat tip there
in
from
regards
Matthews. Yeah.
Got a tingle. In regards to President Trump not inviting them to the White House, he is the president, and at this time, that's his house, that's his party. He can throw it if he wants to, or he can cancel it if he wants to. In regards to the mayor and his statements, I think he's just grandstanding.
Thanks, Dan. It's Trump's party, and he can cry if he wants to.
If you're talking about it, Dan and Amy are talking about it. It's Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. I'm often critical of the D.C. press corps and its local counterparts in places like Chicago. And when I am critical, it's because it's appropriate to be.
Yes.
But I also...
You're not critical of anyone.
I also respect good journalism and will recognize it. And this investigative report on CPS done by the Chicago Tribune is just such a case of really fantastic journalism. It is a report that documents gruesome systemic sexual abuse in the Chicago public school system. They were top athletes and honor roll students, children struggling to read, and teenagers seeking guidance. But then they became prey among the many students raped or sexually abused during the last decade by trusted adults working in the Chicago public schools as district officials repeated obvious child protection mistakes. And in some cases in this report, worse than mistakes, it was purposeful covering up of abuse. The scope of this?
Is this like another Catholic Church scandal?
Yes.
You think it could be that big?
Yes. Well, here's what the Tribune found. The exact number of cases in which school workers sexually assaulted students remains elusive, the Tribune reports, in part because CPS does so little to understand and tackle the problem. Willful blindness. Sound familiar? The district acknowledges that it does not track child abuse by its employees in a consistent or formal manner. Review of documents since 2011, when Tiny Dancer was elected. The Tribune found, and the district acknowledged, that its law department had investigated 430 reports that school employees had sexually abused, assaulted, or harassed students. In 230, so more than half of the cases, investigators found credible evidence of misconduct, conceded CPS. But and by the way, this has become a campaign issue, of course, with the reelection up next year. And I'm increasingly convinced that Lori Lightfoot, the attorney who's running, black female attorney, the triple threat, as she calls herself, because she's black, female, and lesbian. But nonetheless, she's sharp, and she has she put a Tiny Dancer into full Nathan Sturm mode yesterday by picking up this issue, holding a presser on it. Other candidates released statements, but I don't think they're getting the fully grasping how important this is. And it'll be interesting to see if it's covered with the alacrity that the sex abuse scandal in the Catholic Church was covered, or other such instances, because this is an institution, of course, that the left defends without fail, the Chicago public school system. Lori Lightfoot on the report.
We found out last Friday that for far too many CPS kids and their parents, their schools were not a sanctuary of safety, but rather places where children were victimized by predators who masqueraded as concerned teachers, coaches, and staff. The Tribune reporting revealed that for years, children in the Chicago public schools have been victimized by CPS personnel through offenses ranging from inappropriate touching, communications, and sadly, rape. It is crushingly heartbreaking that this happened. When we know from lots of examples across the country and here in Chicago that you must have people who are well-trained to deal with young children and victims of sexual abuse. It is a very specific way in which you must ask the question, make sure that you're preserving evidence. And the fact that that wasn't even in place and still isn't in place all this time later since they've been on notice, there's no excuse for that. But
there's no excuse for it. It's a failure of leadership. And I know that Tiny Dancer likes to do the Mayor Daily when it comes to Chicago public school system and pretend that the mayor is not in charge of the schools. But, of course, we know better.
He is.
And but listen to Tiny Dancer. He's
is he owning this or tap dancing it around? Or a pirouette or a kickball change?
He was using all of those moves. Listen to this word salad.
Look, I think all adults offer an apology. I offer my apology. But the question is, what are we going to do now besides words? What are the deeds to fix this up? I take responsibility, like Janice does take responsibility, to do this. My point is, if you have a suggestion for how to tighten something up, offer that. I take responsibility, and I've also apologized, and I will apologize, like I expect every adult who has any role or responsibility. I'm accountable for me. I'm also accountable to make sure that we, Janice and I, have a plan in place to comprehensively make sure that our kids can go to school safely. That said, if anybody has an idea, anybody, bring them forward, anywhere. But to sit there, my view is to remove this from politics and make sure that it is properly executed, a plan to ensure the safety, security, and education of our children.
You seem defensive.
I'm not being defensive. You're the one who's being defensive. Why is it always the other person who's being defensive? Have you ever asked yourself that? Why don't you ask yourself that?
Yeah, no, thank you, Tiny Dancer. I will ask myself that.
This sounds exactly like the Catholic Church sex abuse scandal. Because they're protecting the players instead of the victims.
Well, also,
and they're covering up crimes.
A plan. You know, let's not pay attention to what's in the past now. We need a plan going forward. Hey, if anybody has an idea, because he got caught off guard by Lori Lightfoot and this being put on his lap. If anybody has an idea, hey, bring forward your ideas. Well, let me just read from the Tribune report again. The district, the same district that's running those commercials through Michael Sachs, ROM's top financier's nonprofit, right? Running those commercials about how wonderful CPS is. We talked about it last week. Featuring Janice Jackson, Miss Jackson, if you're nasty.
I wondered why I got that email blast from her.
The district acknowledges that it does not track child abuse by its employees in a consistent or formal manner.
No, and it doesn't. And take case in point, Stephen Stefania, in 2011, he resigned from CPS. He was caught. He touched the crotch of one student. He also taught disabled students how to circumvent the internet firewall to access pornographic websites. So then he applied for a job in the Florida school district. they called CPS directly, and they gave him them no information about the misconduct allegations against him. Didn't say a word.
And so
he gets away with it.
In the Tribune report again, ineffective background checks expose students to educators with criminal convictions and arrests for sex crimes against children. And CPS failed to disclose to other districts the past employees had resigned, as you're giving one example. But they also have people in the system that are not properly checked out in CPS. Systemic failure. So that is a management problem. 430 cases, 230 of which investigators found credible evidence of misconduct in the last 7 years. That's the definition of a systemic problem. And you're talking about systems to, number one, prevent, to, number two, investigate and adjudicate that are not in place, and the district concedes they're not. Is there any confusion here about where the buck stops? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. Let's give some examples here of what we're talking about, put some actual human beings to the data. 16-year-old honor student aiming for a law career began cutting advanced chemistry and math classes to avoid a track coach who repeatedly raped her in his office. This at Simeon.
Oh, God.
Even after he was arrested, she didn't know, quoting her, she didn't know if she wanted to go to school anymore. She told me she felt alone. She talked about suicide, according to Simeon's principal. At Hubbard High School, Kayana Aguilar was 17 when she reported a security guard for groping her all over. I trust him because he worked at the school, she told the Tribune. He was an ordinary person who violated me. It could happen to anyone. Case after case that are reported by the Tribune, they looked at 108 cases identifying 72 school employees as alleged perpetrators in the last decade. The rest were student-on-student sexual attacks.
Morgan Park, the gym teacher there, was fired. Well, this is a positive thing because he was having... They concluded that he had sex multiple times with a student he had been tutoring after school, but wasn't charged by police because she was 18.
Right. Now the investigative side, get beyond the prevention side, the investigative side too. Mm-hmm. You have a duty to report, right?
Right.
If school employees suspect or learn of abuse, state law and district policy require them to notify DCFS immediately. You can't just walk into the principal's office and make this an internal matter by law. It's a criminal offense to fail to do so. But the Tribune found that some CPS employees chose to investigate on their own, questioning students, their parents, peers, even an accused employee before calling in the experts. Candace in DuPage.
Wait, real quick, there's a student from a woman named Morgan who reported that a teacher at Walter Payton Prep, your precious school, you geniuses, had kissed her face, touched her inappropriately when she was 14.
Candace and DuPage on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning. Congrats on the trophy, Amy.
Thank you. Trophies.
Okay,
no, second place doesn't count.
Don't you think, Dan, that this is like a systemic NEA issue with hiring? I was talking to this guy. He was a teacher. He was retired out here in Elmhurst, and he was a downtown teacher. And he told me, and I was talking to him about how they get hired. You get hired, according to him, via the alderman gives you the nod. So if this is the policy and that you have to be a leftist hack to get a job at schools, is this any surprise to anybody? And I don't understand why parents don't get it. You, time and time again, and whenever this happens, they always say with a little footnote, you know, this is, you know, pedophiles like to hang around where kids are. If anybody thinks their kids are safe in public schools, I mean, I just think I'm not surprised. I don't think that it's Rahm's issue. And
it is Rahm's issue because he's the mayor.
Well, I understand. But what I'm saying is it's bigger than Rahm. It's assistant. It's all over. Thank God for Project Veritas for bringing this to light, because that's just starting the ball rolling. But this is every single county, every state. It's not just Chicago.
Thanks for the call, Candace.
I'm so surprised because to volunteer to be a coach or to even help out in the lunchroom or to go on field trips, you have to go. I go every year. I get fingerprinted. They run a background check and they send that to the head office. That's why I'm so surprised. I mean, especially that guy, Coach Babyface, the volunteer coach at Simeon that you just mentioned, the track coach and the boys wrestling coach who raped that girl repeatedly. He had 4 felony convictions for dealings and possessing drugs. And that was just the start of his long rap sheet.
9 of the 72 Chicago school workers identified by the Tribune as being accused of abusing students since 08 had prior arrests related to alleged sexual offenses involving children or drug, weapons, assault, or theft allegations that signaled they could be a threat to children. John Cass writes about this in the Tribune that, you know, Rahm owns this. Compares this, you know, where your mind naturally goes to the Catholic Church sex abuse scandal. Church leaders actively engaged in a cover-up over decades, writes Cass. The CPS abuse scandal seems more about the cost of bureaucratic indifference, but the outcomes are terribly similar, aren't they? Children were raped and otherwise abused. Like the church, the school system seemed more concerned about protecting itself than putting the kids first. Mm-hmm. So how is this going to be covered? This is going to be interesting. How is this? I know CPS is, they just hired Schiff Hardin to do, you know, a top-down review for a million bucks. They're going to throw some money at it and dispatch some lawyers and pretend they're on the job now.
Well, it's good when people like, you know.
How is it going to be covered, though?
Oh, by the media?
Are we going to get a spotlight? Are we going to have, again, congratulations to the Chicago Tribune reporters. This is excellent journalism.
Yeah, and some of the victims who came forward, like Morgan Aranda from Walter Payton Prep.
Of course.
So they could tell the story, right. I'm just saying that they could get victims, do what they did.
Of course.
When Marian Ahern first started on this story, she received so many hate letters at NBC, and all she was doing was uncovering the truth.
What are you talking about? The church.
The church. But I'm saying, yeah. So I hope they're continued, you know, to be brave and cover this story respectfully that they should be doing and not just burying it.
Right. But this is a national story, international story. To have the number of cases and the type of cases you're talking about.
It's unbelievable.
So are we going to get the kind of accountability that should be demanded of a school system that is a terrible school system? It is a terrible school system, and I don't care how many millions of Michael Sachs's dollars Rahm spends trying to paper over it. For a small percentage of the students, it works. A small percentage of students that would
but
be...
But they're even having these problems.
Well, of course, because it's a systemic. But a small percentage of students where the parents are engaged that would get a good education no matter where you drop them, yes. For the vast majority, the people that could be victimized like this and not have a voice until now, until this report came out, it's not working. They get poorly educated and they get preyed upon. They get preyed upon in multiple levels. So I want an accounting. Maybe this is it? I shouldn't say maybe because that's optimistic. Is this it? Is this where Chicago actually holds for the first time in 100 years the people in charge of the city responsible for what happens on their watch, what they do and what they don't do? Will this be the moment? As I said, when we're talking about California, nobody in terms of the electorate. The electorate has not held anybody in the state accountable in 50 years, Republicans or Democrats. Will a systemic sexual abuse of children demand fleeing CPS the way that parishioners understandably fled the Catholic Church, disappointed with the shock, disgusted by the leadership of the church and what they did? Will there be a reckoning? Is my question. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636, DA, turnkey.pro, text line. Because, just understand, these are people that that everybody pretends to represent. Largely minority families. CPS is 85% black and Latino. 85% free or reduced school lunch. So they're, the lower end of the socioeconomic scale. Every politician in the state says they are in office or they're running for office to serve these families.
There's another case with a choral director who was at Lincoln Elementary and then apparently had a 5-year relationship with a boy, then was able to go over to Walter Payton Prep, and right before they were going to launch this investigation against him, he resigned.
Mike on the north side, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I don't want to shock you folks, but this is the future of the Democratic Party. This is who they cater to, criminals. They have priority when it comes to hiring. We had a whole class get hired by the city. They're either illegals who don't speak English or they've got criminals. You know, they got these teardrop tattoos on their eyes, and we're driving in the truck from job to job. They're yelling out the truck at you know, young women, girls. You tell them you can't do that. But you know what? You can't touch these people now. The Democratic Party, especially in Chicago, has degraded to the lowest common denominator. That's who they play to.
Yeah, thanks for the comment. Well, I mean, look, Preckwinkle and Kim Fox want to open up the prisons and don't want to put anybody new in them. And, you know, I'm all on board for programs that have proved successful with ex-offenders. Right? You know, people in prison that serve their sentence are going to come back and you want them to not be offenders anymore. And there are programs and organizations that do a great job of getting people on a path to be productive after they've messed up, after they've hurt somebody else. You know, this is not what we're talking about here. This is willy-nilly. This is, as John Cass writes, bureaucratic indifference. Raping and abusing children.
Raping.
Is that enough?
And you know how CPS found out about the latest, that case that's from 2012 still? The kid posted on Facebook, I feel the need to tell my friends and family that I was sexually assaulted. What he did to this boy, I mean, I can't even tell you on the radio because it's so gruesome. And then he moved from Lincoln Elementary over to Walter Payton Prep.
Is it enough? Is it enough to hold anybody in charge in this state accountable for once? Or are you just going to allow them continue to say they're serving you while they're actually serving you up?
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM 560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. So there was this terrible news yesterday about Kate Spade's suicide, this handbag designer, right?
Yeah, 55 years old. She married David Spade's brother, and that's why they become Kate Spade, obviously, and she decided to start a handbag company, and everybody yesterday on social media was showing their first Kate Spade bag. Do you have your? Did you bring it in today? Your first Kate Spade bag?
I can't afford Kate Spade.
Excuse me.
Can't afford Kate Spade.
Chelsea Clinton can. She said her first Kate Spade bag came from her grandmother, and how she misses her grandmother, and how it was special.
I'm more down market when it comes to my handbags, but yeah, you know, this is a business started out of her apartment with her husband 25 years ago. And it grew into a business that I think was valued at like $2.5 billion. But her sister said something about not being terribly surprised that she had struggles with some form of mental illness.
Well, and so ever since Robin Williams committed suicide, her sister said that she has been obsessed with that. She would read articles. She would always talk about it. And she killed herself in a similar way. She took a scarf, put around a doorknob, went over the door, and hanged herself that way.
Okay.
It's so, well, but her husband was home at the time, but the housekeeper is the one who found her, and thank goodness her 13-year-old daughter was at school. She did leave a suicide note, and, you know, the part that they released was saying, you know, to her daughter, don't blame yourself, don't feel guilty, just ask Dad.
She'll be remembered much more fondly than one Kathleen Demlow Schunk, who was born on March 19, 1938, and she married Dennis Demlow at St. Anne's in 1957. They had two children, Gina and Jay.
That's nice.
Then in 1962, she became pregnant by her husband's brother, Lyle, and moved to California. She abandoned
That's
her children,
Uncle Daddy.
Gina and Jay, who were then raised by her parents. This is from her obituary that was submitted by her children.
Okay.
They are not remembering mom fondly.
So she abandoned them, you said, after?
Abandoned her children, Gina and Jay, who were then raised by her parents in Clements. She will not be missed by Gina and Jay, and they understand that this world is a better place without her. What do you think about the unvarnished truth rather than not speaking ill of the dead when it comes to obituaries 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro. Answer line 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. This obituary was ultimately taken down. There's a lot of action on it. Some users, you know, were saying that some readers were saying, you know,
give, don't air your dirty laundry.
Well, respect and provide dignity to the dead.
No, I say this is cathartic. Let it out. If this is going to make you feel better to discuss what your mom did to you and if she abandoned you, then so be it. Oh, Dan, how will your obituary read? 312-642-5600.
The Redwood Gazette declined to comment on why the obit was taken down. But, yeah, others said, you know, basically, let's set the record straight. And if that's the record, that's the record. And perhaps this is an example to others that if you behave badly, your children will remember and memorialize it,
and they'll make it public.
Yeah.
Does it say anything else? Does it show a picture of her?
Yeah, it's got a picture.
Wait, let me see. Mm-hmm. Ooh. Yeah. I mean, she's a nice-looking lady. Did it say how she died? Did she fall or was she pushed?
Uh-huh. Yeah.
You could take the stairs or the window, honey.
This is why you probably want to have your own obit written.
Oh.
Yeah, and that's what I do. I'm just going to have... got it written.
Oh, okay.
Just make some edits as you go, add, subtract some things, and then...
Will Hayek be a pallbearer?
Have that ready to go. You know, have somebody ready to execute the publication of that obit before anybody else gets a chance, so that's the obit of record. Mm-hmm. That's what you want to do. You got to think ahead. You got to think about, you know, how your enemies are going to come at you when it comes to, you know, publishing... when it comes to writing the history of you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Back to Kate Spade, though, real quick, because the police spoke about possible suicide at first since her husband was home at the time.
It appears at this point in time to be a tragic case of apparent suicide, but it is early in the investigation. There was a suicide note left at the scene.
It's just so selfish. She has a 13-year-old daughter whose life will never, ever, ever be the same. And hopefully her daughter won't write an obit about her mother.
Well, I'm sure it will be more charitable. The Kathleen Demlow, though, her kids sort of got what they wanted. They raised the profile on mom and her history, even though it was taken down. This became like a, you know, this went viral yesterday.
Oh, really?
So, no.
Be nice to your children.
Well, it was an issue of...
Don't abandon them.
Right, don't have an affair with your husband's brother and abandon your children.
It's called Uncle Daddy.
That's the takeaway.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy, you take a couple calls about that Kathleen Demlow obit, where her kids make sure that it's recorded for posterity, that she... abandoned them when she ran away with her husband's brother. And the world is a better place now that she's gone, they say. She will face her judgment. Related story, since we're talking about death, Koku Istambulova.
Are you sure you don't want me to pronounce that?
Not the name is asked in here. This is...
Koku. Koku for Cocoa Puffs?
Istambulova. She's a Russian woman who's purported to be the world's oldest person. Just celebrated her 129th birthday.
Oh, who wants to live to be 129? 312-364-25600.
She wishes she had died long ago. She's never lived a happy day in her life and has no idea how she has lived so long that she has outlasted her children. She says it's God's will. And she considers her longevity a punishment instead of a gift, as I do each day.
Wow.
Lee, and on the south side, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Hey, Dan and Amy. Yeah, I understand that obituary 100%. I was abused as a child. My mother left my father for a child molester.
Oh.
And when I gave her the option of picking between me and my family or the child molester, she picked the child molester.
Yeah. Well,
and
have you guys ever reconciled since then?
No, I haven't spoken to her in 25 years.
Yeah, that's,
no,
that's a big break.
She also hasn't apologized. She denies the abuse and, you know, does everything. You know, when I was a kid, she would almost on a daily basis tell me that she hated me, that I ruined her life, that she wished I was never born. And then there was the physical abuse, too. So she's just an evil person.
Thanks for the call, Lee. Sorry to hear that, but there are evil people in the world. No
and
question.
Sometimes they happen to be your family members.
Unfortunately, that's true. Ralph and Rantoul.
Yeah, good morning. You know, it's probably there's a time and a place to speak ill will of the dead. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking, you know, one of those times was May 2nd, 1945, when the New York Times printed Hitler's obituary. It's about 13,000 words long. It mentions murder three times and death four times in 13,000 words. A lot of it is like Hitler liked neatness. He enjoyed the friendship of English women. It didn't say anything about he loved slaughtering people and roasting them in ovens.
Yeah, it's funny you bring that up because I recalled this a while back, and I'm trying to remember the context, but the New York Times did a profile piece on Hitler, so well before his rise. They did a profile piece on him when he was coming into power. They didn't believe that he was sincere in his anti-Semitism. They basically...
They thought it was a joke or something?
Well, they didn't think it was a joke. They didn't believe...
Vicious rumor.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
They put the profile of him was like he's a Bavarian gentleman. This is... who enjoyed strolls with his three sheepdogs along majestic mountain trails. You know, mostly Hitler was a hiker, according to the New York Times.
In fact, his obit, they should have titled it... A Peace in Our Time.
Thanks for the call, Ralph. That is a good example of when speaking ill of the dead is appropriate.
You've made the switch, and it feels so good. You've switched to Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Dan and Amy, and since this hour has been sort of the macabre and the depraved, let's continue it.
Okay, what are we going to talk about? Who died now?
Well, of course,
was it murder or suicide?
Of course, we've talked about the scandal at the Dr. Larry Nassar scandal with all the gymnasts at Michigan State that he molested. And
there's the USC scandal with the gynecologists on campus.
Okay, well, I'm sticking at Michigan State.
Okay.
Michigan State physicist Joseph Hattie, 51, charged Monday by the Michigan Attorney General's office with two counts of bestiality after he allegedly sodomized a basset hound.
What? Wait, say that again, but slowly, because I'm blonde. He did what to a basset hound?
Exactly.
And what position was he?
He's a physicist. Former Michigan State president described...
He was a great employee. He came to work on time. He loved his dogs. He wanted to bring his dog to work, but I didn't know why. It wasn't a service dog.
Yeah, the animal control director county there in East Lansing said that bestiality in that part of Michigan is not a very common thing.
It's not common anywhere. They said that.
He described it.
Oh, my God. Look at his picture, too.
He's a health physicist at the university. He's been there for more than 2 years, was also a radiation safety technologist for 4 years before that. So
please tell me he wasn't married.
He worked in the school's veterinary diagnostic laboratory.
Oh, dear God.
Which aims to protect the public by ensuring the health of animals in the state of Michigan and around the nation by investigating and studying and apparently sometimes dating the animals.
It's the Beagle's Me Too movement. Basset hound.
Yeah, basset hound. Uh-huh. Michigan Attorney General's office note that...
would they find pornographic pictures on his computer?
Did not appear to have committed the acts on campus or with an animal owned by the university.
Well, that's good. It wasn't Michigan State property. Thank you.
Yeah, the dog
Michigan State Police providing digital forensic support in their investigation. So there are pictures or videos. Great. Well, that's just fantastic. Do you have anything else, Dan?
That would be a difficult trial to cover.
Can we change the tone of this show, please? I'm dying on the vine.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy, and the Tribune blockbuster report on systemic sexual abuse inside the Chicago public school system. A review of the records that are available, that were made available from CPS under threat of a lawsuit to force public disclosure, acknowledged that the CPS acknowledged that its law department had investigated 430 reports that school employees had sexually abused, assaulted, or harassed students since 2011 in Tiny Dancer's 7 years as mayor. In 230 of the cases, so more than half, investigators found credible evidence of misconduct, according to the Chicago Public Schools. Summary of this: they were top athletes and honor roll students, children struggling to read, and teenagers seeking guidance, but then they became prey among the many students raped or sexually abused during the last decade by trusted adults working in the Chicago Public Schools as district officials repeated obvious child protection mistakes, and I would add more than mistakes, criminal failures like the duty to report. When students summon the courage to disclose abuse, teachers and principals fail to alert child welfare investigators or police, despite the state's mandated reporter law. So the Tribune reports. John Cass wrote about this morning. Because of course Tiny Dancer is now on the spot on this. Everybody understands the mayor's in charge of the schools. He writes, did the mayor approve of bureaucratic indifference and dysfunction that led to in-school rapes? No, of course not. But Emmanuel is a father who loves his children. If he weren't the mayor and had a child at a CPS school where predators were allowed to roam, he'd be the first to say that the mayor was responsible, wouldn't he? If you had a child in CPS, you had a child in one of these schools where one of these incidents occurred, you'd be the first one calling for accountability, wouldn't you? All the way to the top. Everybody would. The question is, will everybody remember to hold people in charge accountable when the opportunity presents itself on election days? Because it hasn't happened in my lifetime in Chicago. Here was what Tiny Dancer had to say in the wake of this report and allegations of his, executive failure.
Look, I think all adults offer an apology. I offer my apology. But the question is, what are we going to do now besides words? What are the deeds to fix this up? I take responsibility, like Janice does take responsibility, to do this. My point is, if you have a suggestion for how to tighten something up, offer that.
Yeah, everybody is responsible. Everybody should apologize. He apologizes and everybody should apologize. But now what are we going to do? Let's, take this out of politics, and what's past is past, but now what are we going to do?
I don't know. What they're going to do, on June 1st, all parents who have kids in CPS, obviously I have too, got a letter from Janice Jackson talking about protecting Chicago's children, and their plan of action, Dan, is they're hiring Maggie Hickey, a former assistant U.S. state's attorney.
Yeah,
Illinois Executive Inspector General. She's going to lead this top-to-bottom review. And then they have recommendations. If you're a coach now, you have to have background check and all this. They have a long list of what they're doing to protect our children now. But the problem is what was the cover-up first before we figure out what we're going to do in the future?
Give me a break. $500,000 to Schiff Hardin to bring in lawyers to do a top-to-bottom review and produce a report in 6 weeks. Give me a break.
The Tribune gave them. They don't need that. The Tribune gave them their report.
That's political damage control. The whole kind of, if you have ideas, suggest them. What are your ideas? You're the mayor. You're the one responsible, ultimately.
You're the
chief executive. You've been there for 7 years. What do you got? Why does it take the Tribune 7 years into your term to unearth what's happened over the last 7 years in CPS? Everybody apologize. I apologize. Everybody apologize. Now let's get to work. And I'm going to bring in a law firm to do a review. That's going to make it all better. Will people buy it?
I just can't believe what went on.
I don't know if people, Chicagoans will buy it or not. There is a real virulent strain of Stockholm syndrome that afflicts Chicago. So I don't know. For more on this topic, in terms of the ideas of what could be done, We're pleased to be joined by Liz Yohr. She was the former general counsel for the Department of Children and Family Services, the agency that the school officials have the duty to report incidents of sexual abuse to. And she was also Oprah Winfrey's child advocate attorney. Liz, thanks so much for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me, Dan and Amy. Sorry we have to talk about this yet again.
Well, yeah. So give us your perspective, particularly your time as a GC for DCFS, and with respect to what is being reported in the Tribune about the failures to abide the duties to report, and how something like this can go on across a system as big as CPS for as long as it apparently has.
Sure. Our experience at DCFS is that schools are notoriously taking on the responsibility, which they should not, of investigating child abuse and then deciding on their own through their administrators whether or not they're going to report it to the police or to DCFS. I mean, my strong belief is this is happening in all sorts of school districts around Illinois. Chicago being the largest, this is the tip of the iceberg. And what needs to be done is heads need to be rolled. People need to understand that this is they're criminally negligent, mandated reporters who do not report any allegation of child abuse in a school setting, whether it's the principal, whether it's a teacher, whether it's a counselor or a school nurse. They're obligated to report immediately, not to have the principal, I'll conduct an investigation. That's why things like, we'll let you resign before we investigate. And that's the dirty scandal that's going on, is that countless teachers are allowed to resign before an investigation is taken undertaken. And what happens is then they move from school district to school district, mm-hmm. like pieces on a puzzle. And unfortunately, this is a national scandal. Amy and Dan, there is no national database of teachers who have been found to be alleged or found to be involved in child sex abuse. None. I mean, we track cars. Every car is tracked in the United States on a national database. But our teachers who abuse children, no. So that's one fix that needs to be occur immediately. Secondly, what also, we always have the blue stocking firms that come in to do a $500,000 investigation. They did it in Sandusky. They do it in all sorts of scandals. And, we're going to implement these changes. That's nonsense. The laws are on the books. They have not been enforced. And so as a result, people need to be charged.
Well, listen, this is one of I just want to run this by you because as a CPS parent, they released this, email blast of what they're doing to protect our kids. CPS says they're going to be beginning to conduct background checks for current employees on a periodic basis. So how is that going to be effective? They should run a background check on everyone. Start of the new school year, go get fingerprinted, fill out this paperwork, have a nice summer. We'll see you back here in the fall, maybe not, depending on, if you've had any arrests while you've been a teacher.
Exactly, Amy. And as parents, we expect a higher standard for our teachers who have our children 8 hours a day. And, and periodically, that's unacceptable. Look, the only fix that's going to is that the parents need to get organized and demand accountability, demand responsibility, and that every single administrator that did not report in those 700 cases, that did not report to law enforcement or DCFS, these allegations, they should be fired and charged under the abuse ANCRA, what we call ANCRA, the Abuse Child Reporting Act in Illinois. I mean, the laws are on the books. We train school districts constantly on their mandated reporting responsibilities. Teachers are told, going through a course. What good is it if the administrators are not reporting these abusers? And if there are 700 allegations, I would imagine that they're triple that. Children don't want to come forward. We know that. Oftentimes in child abuse cases, it's 20, 30 years before they come forward about abuse as a child, especially in a school setting. And, this is a national scandal. This is happening in the rich school districts. We saw it in Lake Bluff where the school district allowed a predatory teacher to resign, and he moved to California and taught for 30 years in California.
Gosh.
Yeah. So, you know, this is happening on a wide basis, and this has got to be a wake-up call for parents and school districts, and no legal firm doing a top-bottom review. It should put anybody to any kind of sense of consolation that anything's going to change.
Yeah, but I take it one step higher than the administrators. You have to start with the civilian political authorities when you're talking about public school districts, because the rot starts at the top. I mean, you've seen it in the last 24 hours with Rahm Emanuel, where he, you know, kind of gives some blanket apology, but not exactly accepts responsibility, while then he offloads responsibility on Janice Jackson.
Yeah, nice.
And this is a series of reports now, just in the last week of Tribune. There was the CPS having its special education programs taken over by the state. Mm-hmm. There's a CPS custodial contract, multi-million-dollar contract that was given a failing grade, roaches and rodents crawling through the schools, but the company nevertheless received a contract expansion from the schools that are under Rahm Emanuel's control, and now this blockbuster report of systemic sexual abuse. It starts at the top. The system is not designed for the kids. It's designed to be a third-party administrator to distribute salaries and benefits for the adults, and so the adults cover for the adults because that's what the system is designed
That's right. I'm so offended by his comment. What are we going to do going forward? Going forward? Well, first of all, there's a political solution going forward, in my opinion. Secondly, you know, how about looking back and finding out all the failures in the system? And, you know, isn't it true, Dan, all the politicians' first things out of their mouth is take care of our kids.
Everything's for the kids.
Everything's for the kids. And then when they get caught, knowing that nothing was for the kids, then what are we going to do going forward? Oh, okay, so we'll just forget, you know, forget the past. If we forget the past, what's going to happen is that this will continue to happen, as it has for decades in the Chicago public school system. And I would venture to guess in every school district in Illinois, because the leadership is not demanding that children are protected. And, you know, whether it's in the schools, whether it's in the Boy Scouts, whether it's in the churches, whether, you know, wherever it is, children need to be protected. And so many of our societal problems come from children who are sexually and physically abused, then come into the system and have lives of chaos and criminality.
Yeah, they become abusers, some of them do, because that's learned behavior.
The adults don't protect them. So, you know, enough of this posturing and start taking responsibility and start saying, you know, I'll tell you, if there are administrators who start getting charged criminally, things are going to change. Mm. Only then. If politicians are going to be held responsible, things are going to change.
But let me ask you this, Liz. I mean, DCFS is one of the agencies to which you're required to report along with the police. But DCFS's record is at best uneven as well when it comes to child welfare. So from your experience as general counsel there, how confident should people, including school administrators, be that DCFS will do their job?
My recommendation is always to call DCFS and the police department in the jurisdiction where the schools are. You need as many adult eyes who have concern for the children investigating these cases. Some of these cases, quite frankly, are crimes. And so as a result, I would prefer to have law enforcement investigating criminal activity. So as many authorized agencies looking at these cases, after all, they're children. I mean, shouldn't we move? And oftentimes what happens is in the midst of a DCFS investigation, the teacher disappears, is able to resign, and then the case is closed. And so as a result, we really need to engage law enforcement. And quite frankly, you know, law enforcement has always thought that child abuse cases are kind of the bottom rung. In fact, we as a public need to demand that these are our highest priorities. Our children need to be protected, and these predators need to be thrown in jail. I mean, these guys who are abusing kids in CPS schools, they don't stop. They continue their activity wherever they go. I mean, we know that about child abuse. Until they're 6 feet under the ground or behind locked bars, they don't stop.
Yeah.
And so I mean, at this point, you know, it's so frustrating. At this point in our society, you know, so-called enlightened society, we're still having this major scandal involving not protecting children while they're at school.
Right.
So, I mean, I plead with the parents. Amy, you know, I was really impressed with, you know, the way that you were advocating on behalf of kids. You always do, is that the parents need to take control and demand accountability, and has it got a role on the top bottom.
Liz, you're former general counsel for DCFS and Oprah Winfrey's child advocate attorney. Liz, thanks so much for joining us. Appreciate your perspective.
Thank you, Dan and Amy.
Thank you, Liz. And she joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Connect with Dan and Amy using the AM560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Oh, boy, things just got strange for this Trump-Kim Jong-un summit.
Stranger. They're scheduled to meet June 12th, of course, in Singapore.
And guess who's arriving a day before, Dan? The worm. Dennis Rodman will be there. You remember Dennis Rodman. He's met Kim Jong-un twice.
My God. What am I getting out of this? I'm going over there out of my kindness of my heart just to try to help. And next thing you know, I come back. Wow. What'd I do that's so bad? I'm not here to sit there and say, okay, I got to be.
So, you know, with that being said, and seeing you get emotional, do you think these trips you've taken have been worth all the criticism?
Absolutely. I think it's worth it.
Because he would go there and bring some of his friends. They'd play basketball in front of Kim Jong-un.
Yeah, he loves the little guy. He gets emotional about it.
He's his widow friend.
He can't quit Kim Jong-un.
Why can't I quit you? So, yeah, we'll see. According to the New York Post, Dennis Rodman may play a part in this some role in this negotiation between the United States.
They're meeting at Sentosa Island. So that would be like Rodman could play Ricardo Montalban and Kim Jong-un could be Hervé Villechaize when Trump arrives.
The plane is here. The presidential plane.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
If you're talking about it, I'll be talking about it. Dennis Prager here. Join me this morning at 11 right here on AM 560. The Answer.
Dan and Amy, well, Howard Schultz, the chairman of Starbucks, who stepped down this week, was on CNBC talking about his company, talking about the American economy, talking about his possible political aspirations. A lot of rumors that he may be interested in running as a Democrat candidate for president 2020. Here's what Howard Schultz had to say about his party.
I will say that it concerns me that so many voices within the Democratic Party are going so far to the left. And I ask myself, how are we going to pay for all these things in terms of things like single payer or people espousing the fact that the government is going to give everyone a job? I don't think that's realistic. And I think we've got to get away from all of these falsehoods and start talking about the truth and not false promises. Right.
I'll tell you what, it's not something I say a lot, but I agree with Howard Schultz about that, and I have the same concern, except it's that the Republican Party is going too far to the left, and a specific example of this at present, and by the Republican Party, I'm talking about the national level, that starts with President Trump. One example of this is this trade war that is in its infancy and may not fully metastasize, but is uncomfortable right now. Larry Kudlow, as great a guy as he is, doesn't seem like he's getting the best of the Peter Navarro, Robert Lighthizer and Wilbur Ross troika in the White House. For more on this topic, we're pleased to be joined again by our friend Steve Moore, CNN chief economist and Wall Street Journal columnist. Steve, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hi, guys. Good morning.
Good morning. So what about the developments since the imposition of the tariffs on steel and aluminum on Mexico and Canada last week? And now we get Canada responding in part and Mexico responding yesterday with $3 billion in tax increases on American goods.
Yeah. Well, a couple of thoughts here. I mean, first of all, Larry Kudlow is fighting the good fight here, but he is outnumbered over in this White House. And you know, my line to the president, I talked to him a few weeks ago about this, is, look, everything is going so well with the U.S. economy right now. I don't know if you guys saw the lead story in the Wall Street Journal this morning that for the first time in 40 years, there are more jobs than there are people to fill them in America, which is an amazingly good problem to have. But, you know, the economy is just firing in all cylinders. We have a surplus of jobs. We have well, the economy is growing at 4.5% now, which is amazing. That in 8 years, Obama never got us there. So, you know, why upset this apple cart with tariffs? It's one thing if we were losing jobs, but we have more jobs than we can handle. And it's very predictable that some of these other countries would retaliate. You're seeing that with the EU, as you just mentioned, Canada as well. Incidentally, I know you up there in those northern states are very worried about Canada, you know, all these goods coming in from Canada. But the truth is we actually have we don't have a trade deficit with Canada. You know, the NAFTA's worked very well. And so I'm very frustrated by this. This will be a tax on American consumers, as Milton Friedman taught us. Dan and Amy, you guys know this. Remember this one? Tariffs are taxes. And yeah. So American consumers will pay more.
Just one follow-up to that. So what about the idea that Kudlow communicated yesterday that of negotiating separate trade arrangements with Mexico and Canada rather than doing this with the two countries or the three countries, including us, combined as a quicker way to get to a deal?
Well, look, I'm a huge fan of NAFTA. I think NAFTA has been, you know, there's been some problems with NAFTA, no question, and you do need to, you know, you need to modernize it after 25 years, but it's been good for the entire continent. And when you think about the next 25 years ahead, it's really going to be, you know, what continent is going to be the world superpower? Will it be Europe? Will it be Asia? Or will it be North America? And, you know, we have so much in common with Canada and Mexico that it's really preposterous to try to blow that thing up. And I hope that doesn't happen. By the way, I would make one other point, you know, which is, you know, I've said this before on your show. I do think China is a big problem. I think China is moving in the wrong direction. They're moving away from freedom. They are becoming more communist again. There's more state-owned ownership of their companies. They are cheating. They are stealing. They are saber-rattling in terms of building their military, arming the North Koreans. I mean, there's nothing to like about what's happening in China these days. And so we should be very tough with them. But if you're going to, you know, one of the lessons of history is you don't want to fight a four-front war. If we're going to get tough with China, we need Germany, we need Canada, we need Japan and these other countries on our side.
Yeah, but they're not going to be on our side if we set these.
We just antagonized them.
But, right, we did. We just antagonized. So why not just have the tariff war with China and leave Germany, leave Mexico, Canada, our allies, out of this?
Yeah, I'm totally with you on that.
Okay, well, talk to your best man, Larry Kudlow.
Well, that's the thing. That's what we've been advising, you know, Trump to do exactly that, you know, and that is probably.
Hello? Did you step into a hole?
No,
was it the question?
I think Trump.
I believe is now
there
the
he is.
Enemy,
he's back.
Which is, and it's just not a very smart strategy. Now, I will say this. I do think that this, you know, we're talking about, you know, the third inning of a baseball game. And this is all, you know, with everything with Trump, as I've said many times on the show, you have to understand it's all about the art of the deal. And he's putting these threats of tariffs out there as a way to get leverage with these other countries to reduce their tariffs. And by the way, if he can pull that off, it will be a benefit to everybody. And he does have a point, Dan and Amy, that virtually every other country has higher tariffs on American goods than we have on the goods that come into this country.
Well, yeah, but as you know, that's hardly an argument. So they're punishing their consumers, so we should punish ours, right? That doesn't make
any
sense.
Okay. But look, you're making an argument, Dan, for sort of unilateral free trade. We should just open our markets to anybody who wants to sell stuff here. And look, Milton Friedman would be in agreement with you on that. But I would, you know, I'm not so sure there's a political consensus for that right now. I mean, I think when you look at China in particular, I mean, it's extremely difficult for American businessmen and women
to penetrate the China market. It's, and then you have to give up your technologies, you have to give up your patents, you know, and you're competing against state-owned enterprises. It's just not a, it's not a level playing field. I think Trump has a point there. And look, I know, Dan, your heart is palpitating. You think I'm not a free trader anymore. I am for free trade, but it's hard to have free trade when all these other countries, especially China, are keeping our goods out.
Well, Facebook has been able to penetrate the Chinese market, apparently, and illicitly so, including giving private access to user data to a telecom company in China that was flagged by American intelligence agencies as a national security threat. Facebook is, and some of our social media giants, sort of problematic. And I wonder how you respond to some of the concerns that have been leveled from D.C. politicians about, you know, Google searches where Nazism comes up when you Google the California Republican Party, and Twitter censoring, quote unquote, censoring Drudge, and some of this information about Facebook user data access to both device makers as well as foreign countries. Is this something that is the proper province of the federal government? Devin Nunes has hinted at more federal hearings on the topic. Is that something that you think is appropriate?
Yeah, I do think it's a problem. And, you know, it gets to the point I was making earlier, Dan, which is, you know, China is becoming a more closed society. I mean, we have 30 years of China moving towards freedom, both political freedom and economic freedom. They, you know, it's amazing. If you want to see the virtues of free markets over, you know, communism, socialism, Bernie Sandersism, whatever you want to call it, you know, look at what happened in China in the 1980s, 90s, and the last decade. I mean, China grew and grew and grew, one of the great miracles of history. But for the last 6 or 7 years, they've been moving in the wrong direction. You're seeing much, instead of privatization, you're seeing socialization of their industries. You are seeing more and more political repression there. And, you know, infringements on, you know, they're censoring things like Facebook and others. That's a big problem. I mean, I do worry that China may be going back in the direction of the Soviet Union, not down the marching down the freedom, you know, road that we all hoped that they would.
Well, then, speaking of China, what do you think about this Reuters report on, a preliminary deal with the Chinese telecom giant ZTE? They pay $1 billion in fines for, you know, stealing American technology, plus $400 million more in escrow to cover future violations. And apparently, according to Trump trade advisors, China is offering to import another $70 billion of American goods if America helps to prop up their telecom giant ZTE.
Well, you know, the ZTE thing was a disaster. I think Trump made a big misplay there. ZTE is a bad company. It has been stealing our technologies and so on, and they deserve the kind of penalties. By the way, it was Trump who imposed the penalties in the first place on ZTE. It didn't happen under Obama. It happened under Trump. I think he made a misstep there. You know, we'll see how that evolves. On this issue of China now saying, well, we'll buy more, you know, stuff from you.
Yeah.
What they're really saying is, you know, I talked to some of the trade reps yesterday over at the White House. They're saying, well, what they want to buy from us is our oil, which is fine, but that's not the thing that we want them to buy. We want them to buy our, you know, our high-value-added products, which is not what they're proposing to do. Those are the kinds of things they have very high, high tariffs on. And one of the things to think about, I mean, this is a bit of a stretch, but just think about this. You know, we were selling steel and, you know, and other kinds of military, you know, devices and so on to the Germans in the 1930s on the eve of World War II. And I wonder whether, you know, we're going to be doing that with respect to China, because their military is growing at an enormous pace, and they are saber-rattling in the China South Sea. They, you know, what happens if they invade Taiwan, or what if they move into India? And it's amazing that they're moving into all these islands all over the Asian, you know, region. I'm very worried about what's going on there, and we better wake up to the new China threat.
All right. He is Steve Moore, Wall Street Journal columnist, Heritage Foundation economist, and chief economist for CNN. Steve, thanks as always for joining us. Appreciate it.
All right, guys. Have a great week. Take
you
care.
Too.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
There's a tale of two events coming up the end of next week. Parkland teenage gun banners are coming to Naperville. June 16th at 6 p.m., the DuPage Unitarian Universalist Church is hosting...
Is this a traveling show?
Jax West. The Lyle activist Jax West is the individual who was reached out to by one of the Parkland students, and then they set this up. The students' Road to Change bus tour will stop in Chicago June 15th for a peace march with teenagers from St. Sabina. Then it'll move to the suburbs of the town hall in Naperville and a car wash fundraiser with some students from Downers Grove North High School. Now, on the flip side, on June 16th, competing events.
It's the Stormy Daniels event.
It'd be interesting to see, you know, if you could go to both and see what you take away from the two.
All right.
Maj Ture, who we talked to last week from Black Guns Matter.
Oh, yeah.
He's got a June 16th event at the conference, Chicago Conference at the University Center, where he's educating urban dwellers about guns, gun safety, protecting yourself. So what do you think, the car wash or the Unitarian Church in Naperville with the Parkland teenage gun banners?
I'd like to go to both.
Maj Ture's event. Yeah. All right, I'll tell you, you go to the Unitarian Church. That's not similar to your church.
I'll go to Maj's
event.
We can switch.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Could the Democrats be getting wise to their electoral problems? At least one may be onto something. He may have actually listened to what a lot of people who voted for Trump and voted to install Republican majorities in Congress have been saying for several years. He apparently has gotten his fill of leftist elitists not named Obama, talking, of course, about Mr. Chris Matthews. The thrill is gone when it comes to leftist elitism. Listen to Matthews's diagnosis of the problem plaguing Democrats in 2018. This yesterday in Morning Joe.
A true Democrat, lowercase d, thinks they're no better than anybody else. That's what a Democrat is. And when the party regains that with white, black, Hispanic people, everybody, starts to think of themselves as one of them instead of being better than them, they'll get back to the party of the people, and they're not there yet. There's too many elitism. There's so much elitism in the Democratic Party. It's so outrageous. And it all comes to the notion of the meritocracy being entirely academic-based. You don't want to hear about a master plumber being an elite. He is, or she is, but it's all academic, and it's a game they've been playing with themselves, and it's self-saluting. And I'm telling you, the people feel it. There's a party going on, and they ain't invited to it. And that's a big part of this. It's not just economics. I don't buy the whole Marxist argument. It's all about economics. It's not all about economics. It's about sensing that your leaders give a damn about you personally.
For more on this seeming cultural divide, we're pleased to be joined again by David Harsanyi, who is a nationally syndicated columnist and senior editor for The Federalist, thefederalist.com. Also, his book, First Freedom, A Ride Through America's Enduring History with the Gun, From the Revolution to Today. David, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Always a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
So what about Chris Matthews and that diagnosis?
I think he's right to some extent, but I mean, a lot of progressive politics and a lot of those ideas are about essentially dictating from the top down what Americans should be doing, how they should, you know, what kind of energy they should be using, what they should be eating, you know, and what kind of health care they need to have and where they need to go and that sort of thing. So, but yeah, I mean, there's also sort of, how do you say, like an aesthetic quality to at least Obama-style progressivism that is elitist. He's right. It's about, you know, how many degrees you have, not sort of what you've accomplished elsewhere. So that is problematic for them. But I also think, you know, there's a cultural element to it as well where you know, it's about where you live. Is it urban versus rural, that sort of thing? So, but I definitely think he's onto something.
Well, and it's interesting, too, because Gallup came out with its values and beliefs survey they do annually. And on the abortion question, you know, what would you think, and you'll know the answer, but kind of for the general person, what do you think the average person thinks if they just watched the news produced by the D.C. Press Corps and its major urban allies, or what comes out of the, you know, kind of Hollywood and the other cultural mavens in terms of what the distribution of pro-life, pro-choice, not a moral issue is, versus what it actually is, which is like 48% of the country thinks abortion is morally wrong, 43% doesn't, and a third thinks it's not a moral issue at all. But if you consumed what comes out of these institutions that are increasingly losing their legitimacy, you would think it's almost unanimous the other way.
Right. Abortion, you know, in fact, I don't know what the latest polls are, but it was trending in a more pro-life way, especially when you start talking about later term abortions after 20 weeks, that sort of thing. I think a majority was for that ban. Mm-hmm. Now, obviously, most Americans, I think, have sort of complicated feelings about it, and most Americans don't drive their entire vote, you know, don't tether their entire vote to the abortion issue. But it is an issue that Democrats have basically gone extreme on for the most part. They want no limits. There's no limit that they would embrace. And I think many of them are fooled by the sort of coverage from Hollywood and elsewhere that most Americans agree with them. It's a really complicated issue, and that's just one of many that I think they've sort of been confused about.
Well, and I don't know if this is where Matthews is going, but this is where he's sort of in the right neighborhood, at least. It's not that whether you're pro-life or pro-choice, it's the attitude for those with whom you disagree, right? So for the 48% that say abortion is morally wrong, they're a minority. And they're essentially, if you don't agree with our position, then you're a bigot of some sort. So pick abortion, pick particularly in the wake of the Masterpiece Cake Shop decision this week from the Supreme Court, religious liberty. If you're not on board with the leftist worldview, then you are a bigot of some sort. And that drives a lot of people away, even if you're not necessarily a conservative.
Right. I mean, the left has essentially stopped arguing. They've adopted this position where when you disagree with it, they treat their positions as if they were, you know, rights, as if they were some sort of religious positions. And if you disagree with them, you're some sort of hater. You could be a racist. You might be homophobic, you know, whatever it is. They no longer argue about the issue itself. They simply dismiss you. So there are a lot of people in this country who I imagine are religious, you know, some sort of orthodox faith, and they probably have some liberal inclinations, let's say, when it comes to economics or whatever else, but they're completely turned off by the liberal dismissal of their belief system, their broader belief system, and I think that is an elitism, and it is problematic for them, because there's still many religious people in this country.
Yeah, and religion's not bad. I always try to get my liberal friends to go to church with me. Like, come on, you like it. My pastor's liberal. But speaking of liberals, you recently wrote an article about celebrating how they celebrate higher gas prices. Why is that?
Well, I always laugh when liberals like Chuck Schumer or whoever else stand in front of, you know, an Exxon sign at, you know, it says 350 gallon or something terrible of that nature. And then, you know, complain about high gas prices. Every single policy that they support would artificially institute higher gas prices. They want higher gas prices. That's what cap and trade was about. It's a fabricated marketplace to make energy more expensive for Americans because they want you to use alternative sources, so to force you to do it. It's, you know, so it's just hypocritical of them to attack higher. First of all, prices aren't that high. I think they've already fallen, but you know, it's just the hypocrisy. They want higher gas prices. That's exactly what they've been arguing for many years.
I want to go back to this, since I mentioned Masterpiece Cake Shop, you wrote a piece on the topic after the Supreme Court handed down its decision that gave good perspective over at thefederalist.com that gave good perspective on the genesis of the case, as well as how it made its way through a challenge at the state level before the Supreme Court took it up. And because you started our conversation by talking about how the left is always kind of telling you what you can do and how you can do it. And in the case of Masterpiece Cake, what you can't do as well, which is allow your religious liberty to influence your professional life. And so I wonder how you interpreted that Supreme Court decision, because there seems to be some disagreement among conservatives. Certainly there is me with, like, David French, who sees this as a watershed moment. And I think it is for Jack Phillips, but I'm not sure it is for religious liberty generally in this country.
Well, actually, I would use this as another example of how the media in many ways misrepresents something. So most people think, or many people I've encountered, think this case was about Jack Phillips basically putting up a sign that says no gays allowed, right? I mean, that's how they view it in general, which is not the case at all. I went out there, I wrote a long piece, a feature piece about Jack and his shop and what had happened that day, and how his religious liberty and his artistic freedom and his freedom of expression was sort of crushed by an unelected government civil rights commission. So the case itself, yeah, I mean, actually, since I wrote that piece, I've actually, the more I read, the less I like it. I just think it was so narrow. It was a personal victory for Jack Phillips, and that's wonderful. But I don't think it dealt with the question of religious liberty at all. I just basically they told the Colorado Civil Rights Commission that if they need to be nicer when they're destroying someone's life. So
right. Yeah, but didn't you feel like, but didn't you feel any, you know, optimism that it was a 7-2 decision instead of 5-4?
Not really, because what happens is, you know, now you have a 7-2 decision that is narrow rather than a closer decision that would be broader. I don't know. I mean, I'm not a lawyer. I'm not a constitutional scholar or anything like that. But I've read it. I've read the decision twice, and I just feel that it doesn't really do anything for us. It just punts the case down, you know, down the road. So I'm generally a skeptical person, I'm generally sort of curmudgeonly about these things. I don't think we're headed in the right direction in general. Listen, it's a victory for sure. There's, you know, it could have gone the other way. That would have been worse in my estimation. But I just don't see how this really helps religious freedom in the long run.
Yeah, no,
it basically gives civil rights commissions a blueprint on how to move forward. And basically, it's just to couch all their bias in legalese, basically.
Well, right. I think that's exactly right. And it's basically an example of what Clarence Thomas warned in his dissent in Obergefell, which is you're going to have marriage redefinition run headlong into religious liberty. And what are we going to do? We're going to adjudicate every one of these cases, like the Masterpiece Cake Shop case, where, you know, was somebody overtly discriminatory or not? And that it's hard to standard set when you redefine marriage out of existence.
Right. Well, first of all, people might not know this because the media rarely mentions it, but gay marriage wasn't even legal in Colorado when this happened. In fact, it was illegal because they had passed an initiative in the state. But more than that, now it's basically courts have to decide, they have to read the, you know, figure out the intent of the commissions, read their minds, and read the minds of the people involved in these cases. It's just no way to adjudicate law at all.
He is David Harsanyi, nationally syndicated columnist, senior editor for TheFederalist.com. His most recent book, First Freedom, A Ride Through America's Enduring History with the Gun, From Revolution to Today. David, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Anytime. Thanks for having me.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
The more you listen, the more you'll know. This is Chicago's Morning Answer.
Morning Answer.
On AM 560, The Answer.
So Bill Clinton, you know, still pushing that book of his. He's trying to dig himself out of the hole that he created when he was on the Today Show and he got hot and bothered under the collar because they asked him about apologizing to Monica Lewinsky. And here we go again. I think this is round three.
On Colbert.
But I didn't like this one because it started with an assertion that basically I had never apologized, as if I had never tried to come to grips with it, and as if there had been no attempt to hold me accountable, which anybody who lived through that and knew the facts knew wasn't so. Nonetheless, I realized, hey, there are a lot of people that don't have any memory of that, and all they saw was me mad, and I seemed to be tone deaf, to put it mildly. Mm-hmm. So last night when I was at my event, we did an event in Harlem with Walter Mosley, I asked to say something about it because I think it's important. People need to know. I apologize. I meant it then. I mean it now. I've lived with the consequences, and I still support Me Too. And I think we all need to keep trying to be doing better. And I would never dispute that.
Fantastic. I mean, what are you thinking, round three here?
Which is the most tedious, mendacious book tour, James Comey's or Bill Clinton's? I can't decide. First of all, yes, there was an effort to hold you to account, but you weren't part of that effort.
Right.
That's sort of an important point. And the apology, as he mentioned in that event at Harlem that he referenced, was to a assembled group of ministers in the White House, bringing in the spiritual advisors to apologize to them. And I love the question about, it's a question about your personal failings, your personal misconduct, and the response is we all need to do better. I love, you take away personal accountability by just talking globally about how, we're all sinners. We all need to do better. Yes, that's true. We're talking specifically about what you did, though.
And he said later he was disappointed with his own bad behavior. When I asked isn't that great?
That's a great one.
It's a great one to
my biggest disappointment?
Was me disappointing myself.
I failed to live up to my standards.
Right. And quickly, this is about Obama. Could Obama have done more to help his wife become president?
President Obama, I think he did a really good job, but I think he could have done even more if all of us who voted in 2008 and 2012 for him had also voted in 2010 and 2014. And I think that...
They did. They just voted for Republicans.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. Listen to podcasts of Joe Walsh and Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on the AM 560 mobile app. Download it today at 560theanswer.com/mobile.
Dan and Amy, we've got bigger matters to address, but I'm a little bit perplexed by IHOP.
Turning into IHOB.
IHOB.
This is a great PR
International
stunt.
House of Pancakes now becoming International House of Bacteria?
No, International House of Breakfast.
Oh, breakfast, of course.
So maybe if you want to watch the carb intake, which I'm sure you're very concerned about these days.
Well, it's just a name change. It's not a menu change.
Well, no, but it's letting people know that there's other thing than just pancakes on the
menu.
Was
anybody confused that you could only get pancakes at International House of Pancakes?
Yeah, I thought it was pancakes only, but they have omelets and everything you can imagine. Now I'm hungry. I'm getting hangry.
Okay. All right, I'm glad we got that squared away. Yesterday, California primary, remarkable result, particularly from an Illinois perspective, we've talked about this. John Cox, businessman, finishing second place ahead of the former mayor of L.A., Villagrosa, behind Gavin Newsom, of course, the lieutenant governor, former mayor of San Francisco.
Former Kimberly Guilfoyle's husband.
The former Mr. Guilfoyle. So John Cox was sort of a perennial, also ran candidate in Illinois for the better part of the first decade of this century.
Oh, yeah.
He moves to California, and now he's, in effect, the Republican nominee for governor of that state. It's wild. I think it also probably says something about the state of the Republican Party in California. But there's the prospect for a watershed moment in California, no pun intended, since they're cracking down on the ability of Californians to use water. But you've got that plus attacks from the left on California public policy. We mentioned it this week, this piece by Michael Schellenberger in Forbes from a progressive perspective saying, number one in poverty, California isn't our most progressive state. It's our most racist one.
Hmm.
Could something be interesting afoot? Well, no better person to ask than a California denizen himself. He's our friend Victor Davis Hanson, a noted historian, National Review columnist, senior fellow at the Hoover Institute, and most recent book, The Second World Wars, How the First Global Conflict Was Fought and Won. Victor Davis Hanson, thanks for joining us again. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
So am I being a bit quixotic in suggesting that there's the possibility for a new day to dawn in California?
Not at all. I think it's kind of a work in progress. I don't know if we're going to make it this year, but what's happening is that the so-called lower middle classes are starting to wake up that they pay the highest income sales gas tax, and their schools are rated, I think, 46th on test scores in the nation. The infrastructure was rated by Forbes, dead, I think it was 49th after Mississippi. Well, only Mississippi was worse. And then we have one-fifth of the nation's poverty, one-third of all welfare recipients. But then what's weird about it is it's medieval. So the coastal corridor from San Diego to Berkeley, we have the most billionaires in the United States. We have some of the wealthiest counties. And we have this elite that runs the state, the Facebook, the Google, Stanford, Caltech, UCLA, all the big Hollywood. And they're never subject to the ramifications of their own ideology. So they don't want dams, but they want Hetch Hetchy water. They don't want cheap energy or affordable energy, but they live in 6-7 degree weather. And the rest of the state, the other quarter and population, is angry about that. But what's also happening is people in that corridor can't buy a house. It's about $1,000 a square foot. And they won't build homes because the people who have their homes don't want neighbors. And as far as the charge of racism, it's kind of accurate because these people, if you go into Atherton or Beverly Hills or Malibu or Santa Monica, you start to see they have big walls around their homes, and they put their kids in these private academies that are sprouting in Silicon Valley like it's 1965 Alabama, and people are, fleeing the recently segregated schools. And yet, what's weird about it is they're all for open borders, and they're all for these radical identity politics policies that are there for high-speed rail, or they're for cutting off water, or they're for wind and solar, no natural gas production. And that those consequences fall on Mexican-American people, poor white people, but not the people who advocate them. And people are waking up to that.
Do you think that any of them feel guilty about their wealth, that's why they're leaning left so much, because they're like, oh, we should give. That's what, the Bible teaches, to give unto others who don't have as much. I mean, what is that a possibility?
That would be a charitable possibility. There's two more cynical interpretations. And one is it's just they are selfish, and much of their money is in capital gains. It's not subject to the same rate of taxes, or they have really good tax lawyers. So they can get around the ramifications of all their ideology. And the other is sort of psychologically, they don't feel comfortable with Mexican-American or poor white people or black people. And they feel sort of, they don't want to be around them. And how they square that circle is that Mark Zuckerberg, you build a big fence around your home, and then you rail at people for being racist for not wanting open borders.
that's a good point.
Well, this water usage law that's coming into effect in California too, to protect against climate change. This is Rocky. I want people to believe that the Silicon Valley CEOs in Mountain View are going to buy this. Starting in 2022, California will limit water to 55 gallons per person per day. By 2030, that amount falls to 50 gallons. Just to give you a perspective, how much water is that? 1 8-minute shower is 17 gallons. One load of laundry can be up to 40 gallons. That's enough to exceed the limit. 1 8-minute shower, one load of laundry. And you're telling me that Elon Musk and Mark Zuckerberg and the rest of them are going to be abiding?
Oh, my gosh. They're probably bored.
I can tell you for a fact, if you go to Woodside or Portola Valley or areas in the L.A. Hills, people have private wells. Not everybody can have a private well because there's not enough aquifer. But most importantly is that this state allowed 55 million acre feet. That's the size of 55 huge reservoirs to go out to the Pacific Ocean this last year. And so the problem isn't trying to ration water. The problem is that we inherited this wonderful water project. All we'd have to do is operate it the way it was intended, or just build 3 or 4 more dams at a price of about 1/10 of high-speed rail, and we would have enough water for everybody. Because the northern part of the state and the Sierra Nevada are very wet. That's where 80% of the precipitation and snow fall. But 80% of the people don't live there. So our grandfathers developed this brilliant idea of the California Aqueduct and 28 huge dams, and it works really well. But not if you take the water out of the dam and you send it out to the Pacific Ocean and the Sacramento and San Joaquin rivers. It was never intended to do that.
Yeah, that's remarkable.
And they're doing it because they like the idea of white water and they want to see if they can reintroduce salmon, and they think the little smelt in the Delta needs more fresh water. But they're destroying the lives of millions of people, and they're waking up to this. And this guy named Don Cox, that you guys know better than we do, he just has 30-second ads, you know. Water, I'll give it to you. Water,
really?
I mean, it's redundant. It's reductions. He just says, illegal aliens, got to go home. Sanctuary cities, end them. And it's John Cox. And he's just been all over the news like that. And people are saying, wow, this guy cuts through all this talk and just gets down to it.
So wait, did you vote for John Cox?
I did, yeah.
Wow. Okay, so he's being received well and warmly in California, huh?
Well, I don't know if anybody knows anything about him. I don't know. I met him once, but I don't know much about him other than the fact is that he's not Gavin Newsom, and that's his appeal to people. Yeah. And he's not one of the Republican sort of Rockefeller, that's an archaic term, maybe a Romney Republican that finds 1,000 different ways to not be conservative. And he doesn't seem, I don't know if he's conservative or not, but when he comes across, the ads are as much aimed at the namby-pamby Republican Party as they are at the lunatic left.
Yeah, it's fascinating. It also speaks to what's happening in the Republican Party here, that there was no traction to be had during his several runs for office in the first decade of this century. But, I mean, just the water explanation you provided, this is kind of stuff that Orwell would have had a difficult time dreaming up. And there's another example of this, and the reason I spend so much time in California, because if it's a bad idea in California or New York, you know it's going to be imported to Illinois at some point. This a story in the Wall Street Journal last week about squatters' rights in California, where you had a small-time landlord who was a landscaper professionally and had a rental property, and he totally got jammed by the squatters' rights in California, where somebody just basically broke into his house and took up residency there. And then gets financed by the state to stay there. He gets through the Sergeant Shriver Civil Council Act, provides civil representation for individuals like squatters to fight illegitimate tenancy against a landlord like Mr. Lopez. It's just a remarkable case, and then it's a remarkable law.
And behind that is the reality that you have this ultra 1%. Remember, these companies, Apple, Google, Facebook, have over $3 trillion in capitalization. The civilization has never seen so much money in such a confined space. So, and we have hundreds of thousands of millionaires in the Bay Area and the L.A. area, and they buy these beautiful big homes, and they put gates around them. They put their kids in private school, and then they give money to politicians that pass these laws that destroy the middle class, which they despise because it doesn't have a romance of the poor or the privilege or the culture of the elite. Mm. And then they try to feel good by helping homeless people or allowing homelessness to be all over Market Street in San Francisco or whatever. But they have ways to navigate around it. But the middle class guy who tries to have a rental, or he's got a middle class home and he wants to put a solar panel on it, but he can't afford this huge electric bill he's getting, then they go after him, and they regulate him, and they fine him, and they make life miserable. And 4 million in the last 18, 20 years have left of the middle class. And that's the demography of California. Middle class leaves, illegal aliens and people on welfare come in, and wealthy people get richer and richer from a globalized high-tech economy.
Yeah, that sounds very well. Illinois is sort of a junior version of that. And yeah, of course, the challenge is, and I wonder if you're seeing this as well, is the worse that the political ruling class makes it, the better it gets for them, because the productive people who are sensible, commonsensical, they bolt. And so your margin for error shrinks because you don't have a population that can get you to 50% plus one through, you know, with common sense proposals.
I think that's right, except something that can't go on, as Milton Friedman used to say, won't go on. And so where I live, it's 90% Hispanic, and I'm in the San Joaquin Valley, and I commute to Stanford, but it's 90 degrees yesterday, and people cannot afford to turn on their air conditioners, highest power rates in the United States. So Hispanic people go to Walmart, and they sit there all day to use the free air conditioning while they can't afford to turn their apartment air conditioning on, and they travel these decrepit roads, and they pay $4 for gas a gallon because of the tax and the special California blend, and then they see these Stonehenge half-finished overpasses for high-speed rail, and they ask you, and they talk among themselves, and they said, you know what? What's going on in this state? I can't afford power. I can't afford gas. I don't want high-speed rail. I want a good road. I can't afford housing. Who's doing this? And then you try to explain, and they tell you, I'm not trying to stigmatize them, but people say in general, well, I don't really want open borders. I don't want illegal aliens coming in. They ruin my school. They make my community dangerous. So I want legal, measured, diverse immigration. And the elite doesn't quite get it. And so that's why I think Cox did well, because the subtext of that, there was probably a lot of middle-class Hispanic people that didn't tell anybody, and in Trump fashion went in and voted for him because he got over twice the votes as Willa DeRosa did, and who really campaigned on being a Latino.
Right.
So I think there's something going on. I think we're 4 or 5 years away from electing a guy like Cox. It reminds me of Pat Brown, 1960, 6 years before Reagan shocked everybody and won.
Interesting. Yeah, well, so enough Democrats get mugged by reality. Yeah, that's what we're hoping for here as well. He's Victor Davis Hanson, National Review columnist, senior fellow at the Hoover Institution, and author of his latest book is The Second World Wars, How the First Global Conflict Was Fought and Won. VDH, thanks as always for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Before you see it on TV, share it on Facebook, or read about it in the paper. Hear it here first. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.